התקשורת עומדת וגם מלא מאחורי הקהילה הגאה, אנחנו אוהבים את כולם ותומכים בכולם.
I'm standing here with this flag today because we don't want to hide it. We have to raise it up to show what hatred could cause. To anyone who had any doubts, I want to be clear, the family is standing totally behind the gay community. We love everyone and support everyone, and they support us. It's a struggle that starts from here. We will uproot the hatred, because everyone are made equal, and it doesn't matter what your sexual orientation is. So Israel now has its own Matthew Shepherds. The two dead and the 10 injured left the LGBT community with a reminder that it has to work even harder to combat homophobia. But it seems like now it may have more partners for the road ahead. The community here will heal its wounds. However, nearest partner Thomas will have to live with the real consequences. But as Israeli gay singer Ivri Lider, the most popular singer in the country, says in one of his songs, Thomas was in some ways lucky. Lucky for having 4 amazing years beside his partner Nir. Lucky for having the chance to love. Reporting for This Way Out in Tel Aviv, Amiran Sikurel.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, Chris Wilson, John Torres, Rex Walker with Bill Kelly, Sherry Lunn, and Aaron Sicurel contributed program material. Ivri Lider performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is underwritten in part by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening. On WRNC, Ashland, Wisconsin, CFUR, Prince George, British Columbia, KFAI, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. For the 1,115th time, please stay tuned.
You can hear This Way Out every Monday between 7:30 and 8 p.m. here on WPKN in Bridgeport and WPKM in Montauk at 89.5 FM and 88.7 FM, respectively. here on your FM dial. Stay tuned next for Counterpoint, coming up right quick after this important message.
WPKN Art Fest 2009 will be here in 2 months, and we're calling out to you, the artist or craftsperson who values WPKN and finds it to be a kindred spirit for your creative life. WPKN Art Fest will take place during New Haven's Citywide Open Studios Weekend, hosted by ArtSpace, and being held this year on Saturday and Sunday, October 3rd and 4th. WPKN Art Fest will be held at Erector Square, which is a highly popular and busy open studios venue. If you are an artist or craftsperson and will be willing to donate one of your artworks to this benefit sale, please send an email to wpknartfest@earthlink.net. Describe the kind of work you do and send an image if possible. Please respond by August 20th so that we may know how many will be participating. We hope that this will be a fun and lively event, and we hope that you will be part of it. Again, to indicate your interest in being part of WPKN Art Fest 2009, please send an email by August 20th to wpknartfest@earthlink.net. And we look forward to seeing you in October.
Counterpoint is next.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds, snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world to its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Beat it up a notch. Speak grunt. No stream. Done that. Start to clatter with fear. Fight down. High wire in a fire. Rivers in a seven gauge. In the government for hire. In a combat site. Net to us are coming in a hurry with the fury. Reporters babble Trump, Kevin Kraft, look at that, no pain, fine, dead, uh-oh, overflow, population common, do what it'll do, shake yourself, serve yourself, whoa, cause it don't need, listen to your heartbeat, dummy, misdirection is the rabbit and the right, right, you patriotic, patriotic, slam, fight, right, like feeling, pretty sight,
it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world. Slice and burn, return, listen to yourself, churn. Walking in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate. Automotive, incinerate, light a candle, light a motive, step down, step down. Watch a heel, crush, crush, uh-oh, this means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear, tournament, a tournament, a tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris here. Mondays between 8 and 10 p.m. Glad you could be with us here this evening. We got a whole lot of things to talk about on this hot August evening here in Connecticut and Long Island, New York, where we broadcast from, or wherever you are. Maybe the weather's a little different, but summertime weather around these parts. At any rate, tonight we are going to be taking on the media in terms of its coverage or lack of coverage of the important national health care debate that seems to have been hijacked by some very well-organized right-wing pressure groups at the various town hall meetings. We're going to be speaking with Peter Hart, activism director at the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, to dissect that one. A little later tonight, John Burroughs, executive director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, will be looking at the issue of nuclear proliferation on the 64th anniversary of America's first use of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and look at the Obama policy on nuclear proliferation. A little later tonight, Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, authors of the book Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, will examine the escalating U.S. war in Afghanistan and the role of Pakistan's long-running support for Islamic extremist groups, including the Taliban. Right now, however, we'd like to welcome an old friend of this program, Gregory Wilpert. He's an author and editor at the website Venezuela Analysis. And Greg is a former Fulbright scholar who lived for many years in Venezuela as a sociologist, freelance journalist, and author of the book Changing Venezuela by Taking Power, The History and Policies of the Chavez Government. Gregory, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Glad you could be here. We wanted to invite you to talk primarily about some of the news stories, which has seeped out into the popular culture, about some recent changes in Venezuela's licensing of radio stations in particular. On August 1st, it was announced that 34 private radio stations would be taken off the air by the government due to a lack of renewal of licenses or illegal transfer of ownership. And this was declared by Conatel, Venezuela's telecommunications agency. Apparently, 120, at least 120 other radio stations are being investigated for irregularities. I guess, Gregory, maybe you could just first tell us some of the background of what happened there with these radio stations in Venezuela.
Well, I mean, this is a twofold issue in a sense. First of all, one has to be aware of the fact that Venezuela has over 600 radio stations. So this is affecting, so far, a small fraction of the existing radio stations. Secondly, most of these radio stations are all commercial stations that play mostly music and are not explicitly political. So this is really, I mean, it's being portrayed as a eminently political kind of action of the Chavez government, but I don't think you can really say that. I mean, it does have some political dimensions to it in the sense that there's been a long-running conflict between the Chavez government and the private mass media in Venezuela, and so certainly you have to see it a bit in that context. On the other hand, these radio stations and broadcasters in Venezuela in general has regularly violated the broadcast regulations and for using the public airwaves, and the government has decided to basically enforce the laws. Some people say this is an opportunistic effort on the Chavez government. I think there might be some element of that. On the other hand, it is necessary to regulate the use of public airwaves. So these are stations that have, by and large, I think, been shown to have violated the conditions for using those airwaves. It's a pretty complex issue, really, and it also goes back, of course, the conflict between Chavez and the private mass media also goes back to the 2002 coup attempt, and the fact that the private mass media have been waging a nonstop and continuous campaign to get rid of Chavez, and so in that sense there is this political dimension to it, like I said.
It might be good to go back to a prominent issue back in 2007. Probably the most prominent issue of the accusation that media in Venezuela is being censored is the case of RCTV, a national television station that was taken off the air, I believe it was back in 2007. RCTV had a real important role in the attempted coup d'etat against President Hugo Chavez back in April 2003, as you had said. Tell our listeners a little bit about RCTV and the role they played in the coup.
Yeah, well, they, along with a couple of the other major television broadcasters, basically broadcast false information during the coup attempt, claiming that Chavez supporters were shooting at opposition demonstrators when this was demonstrably false, and then later on also argued that Chavez had resigned from office when this, too, was demonstrably false. And, of course, with those arguments, first of all, by claiming that Chavez had ordered his supporters to shoot at demonstrators, opposition demonstrators, that provided the pretext for the military to intervene and to arrest Chavez or to ask him to resign. That's how it was put back then, but actually they arrested him. And then by claiming that he had actually had resigned when he hadn't, those were two very similar instrumental aspects of the 2002 coup attempt against Chavez. And RCTV played a crucial role in that, along with two other television channels. The thing is, RCTV's broadcast license was about to expire in 2007. They have had a 20-year broadcast license, and that's the general term under which licenses are granted in Venezuela. And the Chavez government, according to Venezuelan law, has the discretionality not to renew a broadcast license, and they argue that they wouldn't renew it based on RCTV's support for the coup and on the fact that this is important, that they have been violating the new broadcast regulations that were passed in 2004, that they've been violating these regulations very regularly, far more than any other broadcaster. And so that justified, according to the government, the non-renewal of their license.
Well, just, you know, parenthetically here, I could imagine a situation here in this country where if there ever was a coup d'etat against a standing elected government, let's say, you know, some people overthrew a president, let's say George W. Bush, and let's say it was, you know, the NBC network that was supporting the coup openly on the airwaves and exhorting people to go out and protest and support the coup, how long do you think NBC would have their television license? I'm just shocked in some ways that the Chavez government did not take away RCTV's license, you know, 4 years before this,
right,
back in 2007. I mean, if you kind of translate these things into what happens in any other country.
Right, so. Absolutely. No, I think the Chavez government was quite permissive in that sense and basically gave the media a chance to rectify, and some of them did. They played by the rules, that is, by adhering to the new regulations, which were nothing extreme. These are regulations that exist in the United States under the FCC, you know, about when they can broadcast, you know, what kinds of advertising they can broadcast and at what time of the day and so on. And the others adhere to it, and RCTV just continue to ignore those rules.
There's some speculation. With the taking of the licenses of these 34 private radio stations, there's speculation that another large TV network in Venezuela, which has played an opposition role in the past, Globovision, may indeed be under threat of having their license taken away. What can you tell us about that?
Well, that is, there's been an ongoing conflict also, of course, with Globovision, which has been very, very anti-Chavez. And here the main issue has been so far that Globovision has had guests on the air that openly advocated for the overthrow and even assassination of Chavez. And so they're being investigated for that, with the possibility so far that really the most extreme measure has been really only, I mean, hasn't been implemented yet, but the most extreme threat has been to basically shut down the station for something like 3 days as punishment for having broadcast these kinds of statements. As the complete shutdown of the station seems to me so far rather unlikely. Their license, I think, is not due to expire until 2012 or something like that, or maybe even later, 2014. So it seems unlikely that they will go off the air completely, but they might have some kind of penalty, such as a temporary shutdown or a larger fine.
Greg Wilpert, what happens to the licenses of these 34 privately held radio stations that were taken off the air? Are they going to community groups and cooperatives? What's going to happen there?
Yes, that's basically what they've announced. Venezuela has expanded the use of the airways for community media tremendously, and it looks like that this will happen with those stations as well. At least that's what the government has been saying. And these are, you know, the opposition likes to say that these are all, you know, state channels, but that's simply not true. They're really very independently. If you listen to them, they tend to support the Chavez government, but they're also critical of the government, and they are completely independent, with some even being more opposition-oriented. So that's the most likely thing to happen, is that they will be turned over to cooperatives and community media, and that's part of the larger program, of, according to the government, to democratize the airwaves.
Gregory Wilpert is our guest, sociologist, freelance journalist, and author of the book Changing Venezuela by Taking Power, the History and Policies of the Chavez Government. Greg, there's been some disturbing news coming out of Venezuela. Not too long ago, Attorney General Luisa Ortega Diaz said that the government must confront crimes of opinion, new forms of criminality created by the abuse and exercise of freedom of information and opinion, needs to be confronted. What can you tell us about this statement from the Attorney General under Hugo Chavez, as some of that language seems quite Orwellian?
Yeah, I agree. It is definitely sound quite disturbing. The thing is, first of all, there's no concrete proposal that she made about this. She is arguing basically in support of a potential law that some legislators have been discussing. So far, it hasn't been presented to the full National Assembly. It's just in committee. And I think it's rather unlikely that it will be actually presented, because among Chavez supporters, it's already generated quite a bit of uproar. And so I don't think it will really get very far, especially if you consider that Venezuela's libel laws are probably strong enough to deal with any kind of situation, and most people probably will say that this is not necessary, is my guess. I could be wrong, but I don't think that it will go very far. Partly it's also an issue, again, it comes out of this perpetual conflict between the government and the mass media. And there are some, you know, compelling arguments, in a sense, for having a law that would try to limit kind of hate speech. Because a lot of the media in Venezuela is involved in a form of hate speech against Chavez supporters and against people from the, from the barrios, from the poorer sectors of society. And that is a very problematic issue, and the Minister of Communication recently pointed out the parallel to Rwanda, where hate speech was effectively used to commit genocide, essentially, and in many countries there is a precedent to outlaw that kind of hate speech. And the key, though, I think, in the Venezuelan case will be, if such a law is passed, is that it has to clearly define what is hate speech and under what circumstances should it be outlawed in the mass media. So again, it would only affect the mass media, of course. It's so far it's not clear at all how well it will be defined. And again, I really don't know. We'll just have to wait and see once the actual proposal comes out.
There was some discussion in news coverage of media in Venezuela that some kind of legislation might be devised that would actually require prison terms for those who disseminated false or manipulative information. Anything you could tell us on that score?
No, that's part of the same proposal, and like I said, I think in those aspects, I think is unlikely that it. I mean, there's already certainly prison terms for false, for libel, and not just fines, but there in Venezuela there is a possibility of serving a prison sentence for libel. But those laws in Venezuela are basically not. They don't go beyond what libel laws in other countries. I mean, and so in that sense, it's not clear to me how this new proposal would really be different, as long as it defines clearly what it means. Now, like I said, there's been plenty of uproar about that aspect of the new law that makes me doubt that it will actually become a law.
But you say this comes in the context of years of very heated conflict between the corporate media in Venezuela, mostly anti-Chavez and the Chavez administration.
Right. Yeah. No, I think one has to see these proposals in that context. But then, as you can see, there is a very active debate going on in Venezuela with plenty of freedom of speech about these issues, and that's what makes me doubt that these kinds of proposals will actually go through.
Greg, I've read about public forums being held around Venezuela on the topics of media dictatorship, and media terrorism. What do those terms mean to the average Venezuelan or to the Chavez government?
Well, it's basically the notion that the private media has a form of monopoly on the airwaves. I mean, if you look at analyze how much of the bandwidth is used by private media compared to, let's say, state media or community media, the overwhelming majority is by private media, and the overwhelming majority of that private media is opposition oriented. So they basically argue that this is a form of dictatorship, or what they sometimes also use as latifundio, in the sense that this is a large landowner that doesn't own land but owns the airspace, in a sense, and can do with this public space as it pleases. And so this is part of a debate in Venezuela as to, well, what should, in a better society, how should such a society deal with such an important resource as the public airwaves. That's the context in which that's used, and then also, of course, like we said before, in the context of this constant assault of false information and disinformation and manipulation that the private media have been launching against the Chavez government, that this is a form of terrorism as well. And this is something that people in the government are I think, to some extent, rightly concerned about, that this is harmful for people's mental health, essentially, and there's an active debate as to, well, what's the best way to deal with it.
Greg, a new telecommunications law in Venezuela has or will soon limit the private ownership of radio stations to three radio stations, whereas some reports I've read say 27 families in Venezuela currently control more than 32% of all the TV and radio stations licensed by the government.
Yeah, that's one of the efforts to basically diversify the ownership base of radio and television broadcasting in Venezuela, so as to make it less of a dictatorship, basically.
And is that law going into effect, or is this sort of in process?
Well, this is another proposal. I don't know for sure if it's going to go into effect. I imagine it probably will. That's less controversial than the other things we've discussed so far. So that one is definitely a possibility that will pass.
And just lastly on this, how would you assess the state of the freedom of expression in Venezuela today? Certainly, here in the United States, it's sort of our corporate media continually says that there is no freedom of expression in Venezuela. I know there were a lot of active opposition newspapers on the streets every day when I visited Venezuela back in 2006. But have things changed dramatically, or with RCTV off the air and some of these radio stations off the air, has it really impinged on people's ability to criticize the government now?
No, none whatsoever. I mean, if you go to Venezuela today, you can buy any number of opposition-oriented newspapers. There's something like 10 daily newspapers in Venezuela, and I would say about 8 of them, or 7 or 8 of them, are very strongly opposition-oriented. Same thing with the major television broadcasters. RCTV actually continues to broadcast not over the airwaves, but over cable. And I would say almost half of the Venezuelan population receives cable television, so they get it and view it. It still has a fairly high, large audience. So it's still very opposition oriented, and most of the private media, that there's another major private television station that isn't dedicated, the anti-Chavez, but it's balanced and presents a wide variety of viewpoints in their information and in their opinion programs. So yeah, I mean, the freedom of speech, I think, is quite alive and well in Venezuela. The opposition argues that the combination of incentives and of punishments has hemmed in freedom of speech, but I really don't see any concrete evidence for that. The real issue is that there's a polarization in Venezuela and there's a constant conflict that I do think is unhealthy between the government and the private mass media, causes the media and a lot of the debate to be about the media rather than about other substantive issues. And that is a problem in a sense, but it isn't a problem of freedom of speech. It's more of a problem of distracting from perhaps more urgent issues.
Greg, before you go, maybe I could just ask you just a couple moments to analyze the situation in Honduras. In the latter part of his term in office, Manuel Zelaya, the president of Honduras, who was overthrown in the June 28th coup, he attempted to fly back to Honduras on a plane lent to him by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, and Chavez himself has been active in some efforts to reinstate Manuel Zelaya to the presidency of Honduras. Anything behind the scenes going on that we should be aware of in terms of this particular chapter in Latin American history?
Well, the main thing that's happening behind the scenes, I think, is the problem within the Obama administration of being sending very ambiguous signals as to their support is for Zelaya. There's, on the one hand, they've openly said that they want Zelaya to be reinstated, but behind the scenes there seems to have been a lot of activity in terms of accepting Zelaya being out of office and supporting the coup government's effort to run out the clock, so to speak, so that within another month or two there will be new elections without Zelaya being president. So that's really what's happening, which is, I think, the main disturbing fact. And people should really try to push, put pressure on their representatives in Congress to get Obama to take a clearer line as to his administration's position with regard to the coup.
And of course, you have some of the Latin American leaders and right-wing forces here in this country saying that they're very proud of the fact that they got rid of Zelaya because he was another sort of Trojan horse for Chavez to expand his power across now Central America as well as the rest of Latin America. And how would you respond to the idea that Zelaya was a pawn of Chavez in any way during his reign in Honduras?
I don't think there's any evidence for that. I mean, I haven't seen any that is a pawn for Chavez. If anything, he might be a Trojan horse for the social movements in Honduras and for the left in general in Latin America, in that sense that there's a wave of progressive and leftist governments throughout Latin America, and Zelaya, not being originally belonging to the upper class, in a sense, is a Trojan horse in that sense, that he switched sides and saw, or decided to saw which side of history it might be better to be on, I guess would be one way to put it. So in that sense, I think he's so to speak, a vehicle for the social movements in Honduras, but not for Chavez. I just don't see any evidence for that.
Well, Greg, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for giving some information about the media issues within Venezuela and this comment on the situation in Honduras, and recommend to our listeners highly that they check out your web address there at Venezuela Analysis, where they're going to read certain perspectives on issues of importance to people watching Latin America, and particularly Venezuela. News perspectives they're not going to find in the New York Times or on the cable news channels here. Give our listeners a way to find you on the web.
Yeah, it's Venezuela Analysis with one A between the two words, VenezuelaAnalysis.com. And basically that's the best place to go if you want news on what's happening in Venezuela.
And I thank you for all your work on that through the years. But you're stateside now, right?
Yes. After 8 years in Venezuela, I've moved back to New York City, and that's where I am for now.
Well, Greg, again, thanks for all your work out there and for making time for us tonight.
My pleasure.
Take care, Greg.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Greg Wilpert, sociologist, freelance journalist, former Fulbright scholar, and author of the book Changing Venezuela by Taking Power, the History and Policies of the Chavez Government. And, again, Greg is the an editor with the online publication VenezuelaAnalysis.com. We're going to take a musical break and be back with you in just a couple of minutes with a discussion of the media here in this country as it's covered the health care reform debate in the United States. Stay with us. This is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris here on WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKN in Montauk. Visit our website, WPKN.org. Right now, we'd like to welcome to the program Peter Hart. He's the activism director with the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, and co-host of FAIR's weekly radio program called Counterspin, heard here every Thursday afternoon on WPKN. Peter is the author of the book The O'Reilly Factor on spinning Fox News' channels, Bill O'Reilly. Peter, thanks for being here tonight.
My pleasure.
We have certainly watched over the last several weeks as the opposition to health care reform of really any kind has gone into high gear. There are certainly many right-wing radio talk show hosts on the air and conservative corporately funded groups organizing activists to descend on town hall meetings sponsored primarily by Democratic legislators in their home districts over this August recess. And these gatherings have been upended and disrupted by these groups. How well has the media done in dissecting what is actually going on out there in the country as regards to what real people and their concerns about health care reform? Because it seems like a lot of this has been orchestrated to the point where it looks phony. As many people have said, this doesn't look like grassroots organizing. It looks like AstroTurf organizing.
Yeah, the first thing you probably think when you see it is, You wonder where the media got this sudden interest in listening to and amplifying grassroots concerns. I've never known this to be a very, very typical of the corporate media to care so much about what protesters think, but suddenly they've found protesters here, I think, that have been able to flesh out a storyline that the media want to tell, and that is that there are passions that are running hot on both sides of this issue. On the one side, people, the pro-reform camp with the White House, with the Congressional Democrats. On the other side, these folks who are, whatever their motivation, going to these town hall meetings and disrupting them, shouting, comparing the White House efforts to Nazi Germany, and so on. It's a little confusing when you try to get a sense of what's going on here. I was just listening to a right-wing talk show host, and one of the callers had just participated in one of these protests, and he was saying that we were all there anti-healthcare. So you have to sit and wonder what their beef is, and apparently his was with the idea of healthcare. You know, this is, I think, a situation where the media, whatever the motivations of the protesters, the media are wildly overplaying these folks as a testament to real legitimate public concern. If you look at the public opinion on the healthcare efforts, the majority are with the White House plan. The majority would go much further than the White House and the Congressional Democrats are going. That perspective is almost never heard. But what you do hear a lot are these naysayers who are a minority of the population. And I think what they've done is they've sown enough mistrust. They've sown enough anger, and they've spoken up loudly and clearly enough that people are turned off by this whole issue in general, and you're seeing a kind of public fatigue with this issue at all. And that gets interpreted in the media as Obama losing control of the message, losing control of this story, reforms on the ropes, blah, blah, blah. That's really the main way the media cover this. It's as if we're not talking about the health of all of our citizens. We're talking about a political football that people are throwing back and forth.
Peter Hurt, as you said, much of the corporate media coverage amplifies these angry protesters' claims that Obama's health care reform is a Nazi plot where forced euthanasia, forced abortion of handicapped fetuses, the abolition of private insurance and rationing, no choice of doctors, is all part of the Democratic Party reform agenda. Obviously, 100% of those claims are false, blatantly false. They're almost laughable. And yet, has the media gone in any depth to attempt to figure out who these groups are that are organizing these folks, their talking points, and what actually is being planned behind the scenes to disrupt these town hall meetings? Two of the groups have sort of risen above the radar screen, and that is Americans for Prosperity and a group called Freedom Works with ties to a large corporate interest. Do you want to mention what the media has done or not done in regards to letting the public know who's behind these protests?
I think there's been some reporting at the margins. I think one of the great failures is the failure to simply fact-check these things. We can sit here and say, of course, there isn't a forced euthanasia plan in any of these bills. It's obvious. I think it would be nonsensical to think otherwise. And yet, the media don't do a very good job of explaining this to the public. And maybe they feel like it's already well known, but you do see that there are people who believe this, and they're animated enough and angry enough to go to a town hall meeting and yell at their senator or their congress member over it. That suggests that this message is not being challenged forcefully enough, that one story in the paper on one day doesn't do the trick. I think one of the problems the media are falling into is this idea that everybody's exaggerating on all sides. So you see these stories, it was one in the New York Times and one in the Washington Post. Washington Post editorial over the weekend had the same kind of story where they say, you've got it on both sides. The Post editorial was remarkable because they had really four things that they objected to, and three of them were things that the Democrats in Washington were apparently doing that weren't true. One of the problems they had with the debate was that Obama was pointing out that the health insurance companies are very profitable, and that's that's an exaggeration to them. So you've got one side saying that the health insurance industry makes a lot of money, the other side saying there's a Nazi plot to kill all old people, and the media are in the middle and saying, well, both of those are wrong. It does a tremendous disservice to people, and I think a lot of this could be nipped in the bud if the media stood up and did that job. Going the extra mile and trying to figure out who's behind some of these protests, I think it would be fantastic for the press to do that, but they haven't done job one yet, which is to inform people about what is and isn't in any of these bills. And I think that's the real failure. I think some of this is the work of genuine agitation at the grassroots among conservatives, a lot of it done over the Internet, a lot of it done over talk radio. But that's not actually the issue here. There are always going to be people who are going to show up and be agitated because of something that Glenn Beck said. The issue is, who is giving them the tools to organize these events, and what is the message that they're sending? When someone stands up and spouts all kinds of nonsense about this law that Washington's trying to ram down their throats, well, it's someone's job to say none of that is true, and we can either leave it to the elected officials to try to police their own town hall meetings, or we can say to the media, why aren't you doing this every day in every edition of the paper on every broadcast to really drum this message home? I don't know that it would convince everyone, but it would be nice. It would be a nice change for the media to give that a shot.
Is the corporate media, which certainly benefits enormously from advertising by the big insurance companies and the healthcare industry, are they capable of exposing what's going on in this healthcare debate when there's so many billions of dollars at stake for these profit-making corporations? And many of them want to stand in the way of healthcare reform, period, or certainly want a watered-down version of healthcare reform where they'll retain their billions of dollars in profit. I have read reports that these industries are spending upwards of $1.4 million a day to stop healthcare reform. Also, it seems that there's a spike in campaign contributions to conservative Democrats and the reliable allies of the healthcare industry, the Republican Party legislators in the House and Senate, to stop this thing. And it just seems that we don't ever really get the kind of mainstream coverage of the basic commerce, let's say, the political commerce that goes on in terms of who's getting the money. Follow the money is the old adage, and it's certainly true in this case. If we follow the money, we really would know, you know, who's pulling the strings in terms of the opposition to health care reform and who's going to lose.
I think that is the old adage that every reporter swears by, follow the money. And in this case, there have been a couple of reports. I think the main report on this was in USA Today, if I'm not mistaken. But it was about where these so-called Blue Dog Democrats were getting their money. And it was largely from the industry. So you could take it as a just a peculiar coincidence that they happen to have these industry-friendly ideas, and they seem to be the politicians well-positioned to prevent any kind of White House-backed reform. That's either a coincidence or it's a function of where they're getting their money. Now, Washington is certainly a cynical place, and the media is full of cynics in Washington. And you would think that they would put these two things together and say, well, I think I've figured this story out, the same way you would when any other industry is lobbying and lavishing tens of thousands of dollars on different politicians, that they're giving this money for a reason, not because they like the guy and they think he has nice parties, but because they want something from him. And politicians will obey their corporate donors. So this is the simplest part of the story, and it's the one that I think evades a lot of scrutiny in the press. Again, when you look back at the kind of tiresome coverage that we've seen over the last couple of weeks, it's, does Obama have any momentum? Has he lost momentum? Is he gaining it back? Are the Republicans resurgent? Is the GOP back? None of this stuff matters to the core issue, which is whether or not there is going to be any kind of health care reform in the next couple of weeks or months. But this is the way Washington covers Washington. And like you said, it's a very profitable enterprise right now. The interest groups are fired up to spend millions of dollars to either defend the status quo or to try to change the status quo. And the media, I think, you know, would not do themselves any favors if they stood up and said, this ad right here is full of lies. That's not an ad that's going to be placed twice. So it is, I think, one of the core things that compromises the corporate media in any season, whether it's election season or this very kind of special, unique legislative season that we're in right now.
We're speaking with Peter Hart, Activism Director with the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Peter is a contributor to FAIR's monthly magazine, Extra, and co-host of FAIR's weekly radio program, Counterspin, heard on this station on Thursday afternoons. Peter, Dick Armey is a key figure in all this. He's a former Republican House Majority Leader. He now works with a lobbying firm called DLA Piper, which among the big corporations on its client list are Medicines Company, with obvious interest in pharmaceuticals. It seems that Dick Armey's role here as chair of one of these so-called grassroots groups, Freedom Works, and as a paid lobbyist, really should be known far and wide, if not by the general public, then the people who are attending these rallies railing against health care reform, repeating the talking points that were put together by Dick Armey and his group. It seems unfair to even those folks who are spouting the line not to know where the money in the organization is coming from.
Yeah, and you know, you see this, and I think it's a function of a lot of these town hall events, is that people are standing up and saying, nobody sent me, which I think is a response to this idea that this is an entirely manufactured movement controlled by a couple of poobahs in Washington. These folks don't believe that, and they don't feel that, and they weren't sent there to spout anyone's talking points. And I think that's the beauty of AstroTurf organizing like this. It's intended to look like it's spontaneous, and it's intended to feel spontaneous. The fact of the matter is the talking points are the same, whether you're hearing them on the talk radio show that you're devoted to, or whether they're coming out of some think tank in Washington or a lobbying group in Washington. So I think you have a situation where the agendas are set, and the talking points are set, and they're distributed far and wide. So if I'm hearing it from Michael Savage, I don't know who Dick Armey is. I know that I heard it from Michael Savage, and that's what made me upset. I was listening to him tonight talking about Obama traveling to Mexico to have a town hall there because those are the people that voted him into office in the first place. This is the kind of nonsense that's out there, but enough of it will inflame a certain small segment of the population, and they will go out and participate in these events. You know, there's been a lot of back and forth among protesters on the left saying, well, you know, this is protest. This is citizen protest. Shouldn't we? How can we say that this protest is illegitimate and ours is legitimate? And you know, of the many thousands of differences, I would say that people protesting against the invasion of Iraq were protesting against the invasion of Iraq. They weren't inventing a Bush plot to invade Mars. And this is, I think that's what these people are doing at these town hall events. They're talking about things that have no relationship to any health care reform bill anywhere. But they're fired up about it, and they're passionate, and they're demanding that their lawmakers not pass this completely made-up bill. So I think it's very frustrating for people watching this because, on the one hand, you want to encourage citizen activism and even, in some cases, outrage. But on the other hand, you can identify something that's made up, that's phony, and that's completely false. And I think the big difference is that in this case, the media, for whatever reason, have decided that this is an interesting point of view, and it's a much more interesting story than, say, anti-Iraq war protests or protests in favor of a single-payer system in the United States. Those things are not allowed in the media discussion. Loud people ranting about how Obama is the second coming of Adolf Hitler, on the other hand, well, that's a news story that apparently everyone feels a need to cover, and cover mostly uncritically.
Yeah, and I think the point you make about we have to be careful, because certainly protest is, you know, should be the lifeblood and be the protected lifeblood of our democracy. And whether you're on the left or the right or the middle, yeah, that privilege and that right, rather, of protest should be protected at all costs. And I think, you know, groups like Code Pink or Move on the left, who protest at various public meetings, you know, certainly the media has a job to figure out who these folks are, where they come from, where their funding comes from. But I think just the absence of that on the right in these very sort of dramatic and extremely saturation-covered protests around healthcare reform, the fact that it's not happening in this, when the ties to the insurance industry are so clear that people are going to profit from it, that's what I find disturbing. Peter, I wanted to ask you something else regarding the media and its motivation for how it's covering this. Is it true that the media, having been on the receiving end of so much criticism from the Republican Party and the right in general for having a liberal bias, is afraid to really call out these anti-healthcare reform groups and the activists and their talking points because they're concerned that they are going to, again, be criticized as the quote-unquote liberal media? So therefore, they just say nothing.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to get in their heads, so all you can do is go by their performance and evaluate that. And when you see reports that don't lift a finger to check the outrageous and outlandish claims that you're hearing at these events, then I think the question answers itself, and the media is taking a mostly hands-off approach to this. Now, if anti-war protesters gathered at congressional town hall meetings across the country and disrupted them with the intent of shutting down the meetings and said, we're here to shut this thing down, well, you can expect that the media would treat it very differently. And you would see some discussion about how out of step these folks are and how extreme and how potentially violent they are and so on and so forth. I think these events or these protests are given a certain kind of respect by the media. And you can disagree about whether they deserve that respect, but I think the telling part is that the coverage is often uncritical and certainly doesn't bear any resemblance to protest coverage when the protesters are progressive or on the left. I think that's the main distinction. You know, it is, of course, as you said, it's an American right to protest, but when you show up demanding that the other side shut up and listen to you and drowning out any serious discussion, well, then we have another conversation about what American tradition is. And this would not be, I don't think you would find much in American history that would suggest that it's an all-American activity to make sure that your opponents don't get a chance to speak and you threaten them and so on and so forth. So I think we've seen a lot of really chilling behavior in the last week or so. And it doesn't show, you know, if listening to right-wing talk radio is any sign, it doesn't show any signs of letting up right now. That they do feel, and I think this is a function of the way the media is covered, they do feel like they're getting somewhere, that they're having an impact, that they've changed this debate. And once they feel that way and they have that momentum and they have that confidence, it's not going anywhere. So I think this is going to be with us for the next week or two, probably, at the very minimum.
It would seem that the responsible corporate media would go out into the field and talk to real people with real problems with their health care, with private insurance, with the limitations and rationing that goes on with private insurance today, and the issue, for instance, that the single largest cause of personal bankruptcy in this country are people being deluged by health care bills. I mean, this is the story that needs to be told about why health care reform needs to happen, not why it doesn't need to happen because it's a Nazi plan. I mean, this is insane. But, Peter, I wanted to ask you about one aspect of the media coverage of this and a lot of other issues. It seems that media coverage of issues in general, and particularly on the cable news talk shows, are really anchored in the daily comments of Rush Limbaugh, Lou Dobbs, Bill O'Reilly, Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, and Michael Savage. And that seems to be like the start and end for a lot of the topical coverage of this or that issue. Is that healthy? I mean, you know, some of it's critical of these guys and their talking points, but others just sort of kind of let these things go by, and it kind of has a way of being part of the echo chamber. You know, Michael Savage says something in his radio show, and then it's amplified, you know, 100 other places. Whether it's critical or not, it just seems like it's giving these what I would consider very irresponsible men in the media undue coverage. What do you think?
I think it's a good point. You know, I saw something today about how most of the coverage of this so-called birther movement, suggesting Barack Obama wasn't born in this country, most of that coverage you're on television, you're seeing on MSNBC, which is known as obviously a more liberal channel. The purpose of that coverage is to poke holes in this theory and to mock the people who are advancing it. But you see that it has become almost an obsession among people at MSNBC that we're going to keep talking about this and keep talking about this. Now, they're having fun with it, but it raises that question that you're asking. That how much of this do you need to do? How much of Lou Dobbs' radio show rants do you need to transmit to the world and respond to? And I think that's a difficult dilemma for a lot of people who are in this world, because it does set up the idea that you are debating Lou Dobbs or that you are debating Michael Savage, when really the healthcare debate, I think, has a lot more nuance in it. And one of the ways you see this play out is on some of the shows like Olbermann's on MSNBC. They are as adamant about distancing themselves from single payer as Barack Obama is. There's very little discussion of, well, why not on those channels. They approach the issue that way because they're trying to rebut the right-wing talking points. So the right-wing says, oh, he's trying to have a national health care system, and Olbermann and company say, no, that is absolutely not what we're having. And instead of saying, well, why not, and what is Obama's rationale for taking this off the table, it's simply there to defend Obama and set up that Obama versus Savage or Dobbs or whomever debate. And I think that marginalizes a lot of important opinion, and also veers us off course from what we should be talking about, which is the state of healthcare in this country and the rationale for some sort of action, which is really a story that, as you said, goes begging. You know, Michael Moore tried to do it in his film. That was considered a work of remarkable advocacy in the mainstream media for telling stories about how people interact with the insurance industry. That is simply not something that they do. And, you know, when you take all of these pieces away, all of these important issues that the media are afraid to talk about or unwilling to talk about, you don't have much left, and that's what we have on our television screens right now. Shouting about what's going on at town halls and all kinds of nonsense about, you know, who's up, who's down in Washington. It's a much more important story than that, but you wouldn't know it by watching television.
Peter Hart, as always, I like to conclude with this question to you. How most effectively can listeners and viewers and readers of their media talk back to the editors and the news directors, urging them to take a different tact when they cover these important issues like health care reform and the national debate?
I think it's important to talk to reporters and editors about the things that you wish you saw more of. It's not usually wise to call up a reporter and say, you never do A, B, and C. Because chances are somewhere along the line they did it, and reporters are remarkably thin-skinned, and they're going to find it and show you that you're wrong about that. It's not a debate you want to get into with a reporter. Instead, it makes sense to say, these issues are important. These perspectives I feel like are missing. These are the things I'd like to, these are the questions that should be asked of the politicians. Approach them, it sounds strange because, you know, this isn't your job and it's not my job, but approach them like you yourself are writing these stories. You yourself are covering this issue. Approach them and talk to them like a journalist, which is not to launch all sorts of attacks or anything like that, but it's to say this issue is important, and I think these are the perspectives that are missing most often from your paper or your channel or your radio station, and see what they say. You know, it's remarkable that there are a lot of reporters out there, even when you criticize what they're doing, who will be happy to talk to you about it and and hear you out. They're not going to agree with you most of the time, and some of them, frankly, will not be happy to talk to you. But they'll hear you out, and they'll listen to what you have to say. And I think that's the kind of constructive relationship. I've seen dozens of examples over the years of people who've cultivated reporters and kept pushing on them and pushing on them, and then you would eventually see the stories that you think aren't there are suddenly there, or the people you wish were quoted are suddenly quoted, or the op-eds you want to see are the op-eds that they're publishing. This stuff is all possible, and it helps change the dynamic and the debate in your community, but it's certainly not easy work. And in the meantime, you have to bolster and be devoted to the independent outlets who are doing the kind of job you think everyone else should be doing.
Well, Peter, thank you again for being here tonight and all your work with FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And our listeners can find a lot of information and analysis at the website of your group, FAIR. That's FAIR.org, right?
Yes.
Okay. Again, thanks for being here with us tonight, Peter.
Thank you, Scott.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Peter Hart, Activism Director with the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. Again, that's FAIR.org. Get a lot of very important analysis and critique of the major corporate media. We're going to take a little musical break here and then be back with a discussion of nuclear proliferation issues on this 64th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Ending World War II. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. Visit our website at WPKN.org, and you can always go there to find out a bit about how to volunteer, our program schedule, and how you can make a secure online contribution. That's WPKN.org. Right now, a little music to take us into the next interview. Stay tuned.
The CIA is pushing crack in the ghettos of L.A. while the food crops in Colombia get sprayed by the DEA. The FBI is reading your email with something called the carnivore. While the rich are getting richer and the poor are staying poor, they're launching nuclear-powered ships up into space. One little accident could wipe out half the human race. They're putting radioactive waste into your silverware, or maybe your toaster, or perhaps your wheelchair. The Air Force is bombing Iraq every other day. They don't like the government, so the children have to pay. And the ozone hole is growing, the sheep are going blind, while the U.S. spends more on arms than the rest of the world combined. Journalists are getting fired from San Jose to Atlanta when they write about reality, not a fluff piece for Fanta. A death threat every week, and sometimes life is short when the truth is too dangerous for someone to report. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? The cancer rates are skyrocketing, though people are smoking less. If you live near a nuke, your life is bound to be a mess. Clean water's almost gone all over the earth, and what's left they want to privatize and see how much it's worth. Chevron is gunning down the students of Nigeria, turning the land to waste while the babies die of diphtheria. And the temperatures are rising, the world's forests are on fire. Pretty soon Brazil will be one raging funeral pyre. Who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times?
Music from David Rovix here on WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk. Right now at Counterpoint, I'd like to welcome to the show John Burroughs, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. John, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
Yeah, glad to be with you, Scott.
course, I'm sure all of our listeners are aware that these few days here, August 6th and August 9th, mark the 64th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, ending World War II in 1945. An estimated 140,000 people died in Hiroshima and 80,000 died in Nagasaki by the end of 1945. And then, of course, hundreds or thousands more died in the years after that due to radiation poisoning. And, John, as we stand here today in 2009 and look at the state of the world and nuclear proliferation and the danger of nuclear war, what's your status report? And we can certainly talk about the Obama administration and what their plans are to stop nuclear proliferation, as certainly was a point made by Barack Obama when he ran for the presidency in 2008. But how much concern do you have that nations will be gaining nuclear weaponry technology and that we will see a dangerous proliferation of nuclear weapons across the globe?
Well, let's start with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, it's truly amazing how strong the Japanese nuclear abolition movement is, and in particular, the strength of the Hibakusha, the survivors of the bombings, who are getting old now, and some of them are dying, but they are very outspoken regarding the need to abolish nuclear weapons. And we have really seen sort of a shift in global elite public opinion in a certain way. This past week in Nagasaki, in Hiroshima, the UN under High Representative for Disarmament Affairs, Sergio Duarte, was there. The President of the General Assembly was there, Miguel Descoto, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, is in the midst of a campaign leading up to the International Day of Peace centered on nuclear disarmament. And in fact, he even has among other things, a Facebook campaign and a Twitter campaign going under the name We Must Disarm. WMD, We Must Disarm. and you mentioned Barack Obama. Well, Barack Obama made just an amazing speech in Prague, April 5th of this year, where he said, regarding the bombings, he said, as the only nuclear power to have used nuclear weapons, the United States has a moral responsibility to act. And he said the United States seeks a world without nuclear weapons, the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. But, you know, other presidents have certainly not acknowledged the U.S. role in starting the nuclear age by bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But other presidents, going back to Kennedy or even Eisenhower and all the way through, with the exception, I suppose, of George W. Bush, have talked about the goal of elimination of nuclear weapons, but Obama has been more concrete, some would say more pragmatic. So in his Prague speech, he talked about some things perhaps we can discuss in a little bit, the Test Ban Treaty, Fission Materials Treaty, reductions with Russia. But I think more it was his rhetoric that really has marked sort of a shift that's been occurring for several years now, where there's much more receptivity, at least in a certain segment of elite opinion, to the idea of taking steps that lead toward the elimination of nuclear weapons. Now, as you alluded to, there are certainly things going in the other direction. North Korea, above all. North Korea just did another nuclear test in May. It's been testing missiles. North Korea is the ninth country to have nuclear weapons after the United States, France, China, United Kingdom, Russia, and then India, Pakistan, Israel. Then comes North Korea. and Pakistan and India seem to be settling into a nuclear arms race. They both continue to produce fissile material for weapons. And Iran, whether or not deliberately, is just by virtue of the fact that it's acquiring a uranium enrichment capability, it's acquiring the ability to produce materials for weapons, and that poses sort of the specter of counter-nuclearization in the Middle East. So we're in a moment where you have currents going both ways, but I would certainly say that since Reagan and Gorbachev were briefly talking about the elimination of nuclear weapons at Reykjavik in 1986, this is a time when it's this is the first time since then that it's really been something that's been widely spoken about.
Our guest tonight on Counterpoint is John Burroughs, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. And we're talking about the proliferation of nuclear weapons on this 64th anniversary of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, John, I wanted to talk about the treaties that were abandoned by George W. Bush. Tell our listeners a bit about the treaties relating to nuclear weapons, their testing, and their proliferation across the globe that were abandoned by the Bush administration, and what Barack Obama is bringing to the table that's any different?
Well, probably most importantly, the Bush administration withdrew from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty in 2002. Now, that was the treaty that limited the deployment and the testing of anti-missile systems on the basis that it would contribute, such deployment would contribute to nuclear arms race between the two countries as they tried to compensate for the other side deploying anti-missile systems. So the idea of the ABM treaty was that it would preserve a relationship of mutual vulnerability between the United States and the Soviet Union and Russia. Of course, this is a hard thing for people to swallow, the idea of being vulnerable to another country's nuclear attack as a means of having stability, and the right wing in particular never liked it, so the Bush administration withdrew, and that makes it harder to reduce the numbers of nuclear weapons and their delivery systems, because there's the fear that as you get down to lower numbers, the other side might be able to combine a preemptive strike with backup missile defenses in order to, quote, win a nuclear war. Of course, Reagan and Gorbachev said a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. But the Bush administration withdrew from that treaty. Now, what is the Obama administration doing about that? So far, not too much. The Bush administration started deploying, or at least making plans to deploy and building sites to deploy, anti-missile systems based in the Czech Republic and Poland. And this just drove, supposedly in order to counter Iranian missiles, this just drove the Russians crazy because they saw it as directed against them. And, you know, they had technical arguments why that was the case. And some of the U.S., the Bush administration would say, well, you know, the Russian forces are so large, this just a few interceptors could hardly make a difference. But from the Russian point of view, it was like an opening wedge. The Obama administration has not said it's going to go ahead with the missile defense deployments in Europe. But it has not said it's not going to go ahead. Basically, they're just putting that one on the back burner. And Obama's position is, you know, missile defenses won't be deployed unless they're proven to work and cost effective. Well, you know, no missile defenses essentially have ever been proven to work. It's a very hard thing to do, even for a country that landed a man on the moon. It's a hard thing to come up with an effective anti-missile system that can deal with, among other things, decoys.
Yeah, countermeasures are real cheap. You could throw off a lot of chaff or whatever the right. technical term is, and you could do that for $1.98, whereas how to detect what's chaff and what's real is, I guess that's real expensive technology or maybe unattainable.
Yeah, that's right. So I would say the Obama administration has not bitten the bullet on that one. And you know, to be fair, it's a little bit like you remember the Clinton administration was talking about doing various things in 92 and 93. Then the congressional elections came in 94, and the Republicans swept the table. And all of a sudden, a lot of things the Clinton administration was going to do, including, you know, some cutbacks on military nuclear spending, they were just, those ideas were gone. Well, you probably have seen that the United States and Russia are currently negotiating, you know, modest reductions in deployed long-range strategic nuclear forces. The current agreement allows deployments of operational weapons, as they say, up to 2,200, and so apparently they're now talking about having numbers like 15 or 16 or 1,700. So the Senator Kyle, put forward an amendment which was adopted by voice vote, meaning nobody opposed it, no Democrat opposed it, saying that in the next fiscal year, this was the Defense Authorization Act, that no arms reduction agreement would be funded if there were limits on missile defenses and if there were limits on advanced non-nuclear delivery systems. Well, those are two of the things that are of the most concern to Russia on non-nuclear delivery systems. They're worried that the United States, the Pentagon, may be eventually have be able to deliver non-nuclear warheads by missile that could pose a threat to their what the Russians would regard as their deterrent. So this is the sort of thing that you know that Obama is facing. There's still a pretty powerful lobby to understate the matter for a very kind of full bore approach to, you know, U.S. military supremacy that exists in the U.S. government.
John, I know that there are two important dates coming up. September 24th, there's the United Nations meeting on nonproliferation at the New York UN headquarters. And then in May 2010, there is a review of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Tell us, what are the opportunities and dangers there in terms of moving towards the abolition of nuclear weapons at these two events?
Well, you know, the International Day of Peace on September 21st, it takes place every year. And this year, it's on the theme of achieving a nuclear weapons-free world. And as I mentioned, the UN Secretary General has really focused on this. And there don't seem to be, I just looked a little while ago, there don't seem to be any details yet about exactly what's going to be involved there. But, you know, if you want to find out about all this, I suggest to just Google "We Must Disarm," and all one word, and I think that'll turn up some information. But the really major event is, as you said, next spring, every 5 years, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty is reviewed, meaning all aspects of the treaty are looked at to see how well it's operating and how well it's being implemented. And you asked me earlier, what treaties did the Bush administration undermine or reject? Well, another one was the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, because the Bush administration focused only on the prohibition contained in that treaty on acquisition of nuclear weapons by countries that have agreed not to acquire them, and that's almost all countries in the world under the NPT. So they were focused, for instance, on activities of Iran, which they believe were leading towards acquisition of nuclear weapons. But there's another aspect to the treaty, and and that's Article 6, which requires good faith negotiation on nuclear disarmament. And that rather vague promise has been given some substance by commitments made at these five-year review conferences in 1995 and 2000 to the Test Ban Treaty, the Fission Materials Treaty, verified reductions leading to elimination, diminishing role of nuclear weapons in security policy, preservation of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Well, the Bush administration ran away from several of the most important commitments there, including the Test Ban Treaty and the ABM Treaty, certainly did not reduce the role of nuclear weapons in security policy, was the major cause of the failure of the 2005 review conference to come to an agreement. And now the Obama administration has come in, and as I said, in Prague, Obama said, well, we're going to go ahead with the Test Ban Treaty and the treaty banning production of fission materials and uranium and plutonium for nuclear weapons. And we're going to go ahead with verified reductions with Russia. So in a lot of ways, the Obama administration has taken up the commitments that had been made in the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty context, and said, we're going to fulfill these. So there's a lot of thought. I was just at a preparatory meeting, governmental preparatory meeting this past spring for next year's review conference, and there's definitely a different atmosphere because of the way the Obama administration is coming into this. One thing that the NGOs are doing is, the non-governmental organizations, is saying that, well, that's fine and good to do things like the Test Ban Treaty or reducing the size of the arsenals. However, to really come to grips with the problem, you know, you can do all those things, and unfortunately, unless you did verified reductions to zero or fairly close to zero, but as things are now sort of projected to go, the major powers in the world are still going to have very capable and sizable nuclear forces. So you do all these measures, but you still have the same problem of, you know, civilization destroying arsenals ready to use if governments decide to use them. And so the NGOs are saying, and this is from around the world, that there needs to be a process initiated next year, like at the review conference, which deliberately is intended to lead towards the creation of a nuclear weapons-free world. And United for Peace and Justice, the Nuclear Disarmament Working Group, and Peace Action, and other groups have come up with a very nice petition. I can say that partly because I helped to write it. I think it's a good petition. It quotes Obama. It quotes some of the things I said earlier, and like the United States has a responsibility to act because it bombed Japan, and says, it's great that you're saying these things. And then it goes on and say, now you must act on those words and initiate negotiations on the elimination of nuclear weapons. And there's quite a demand for this. You know, talking about major peace movements in other countries, Mayors for Peace, headed by the mayors of Hiroshima, Tadatoshi Akiba, and Nagasaki, Mary Taui. There's about 3,000 mayors around the world who have joined Mayors for Peace, and they're saying the same thing. By the way, we got in Providence, the U.S. Conference of Mayors had its annual meeting in June, and the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the major mayors organization in the country, endorsed the Mayors for Peace position on the need to commence negotiations leading to elimination. So there's, you know, a fair amount of momentum behind this, and there's going to be thousands of people at least from around the world in New York next May, and I, you know, I encourage people to start thinking about coming there. And you can see the petition at on the Peace Action site or at unitedforpeace.org.
And John Burroughs, citizen activism, I think when it comes to nuclear weapons and the issues of abolition, you know, there hasn't been a lot of street activity on that issue lately. And, of course, a lot of that owes to what's sort of been the focus of our attention since September 11th, 2001, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the economic collapse here, the health care debate. I mean, there are you know, hundreds of things on everybody's radar screen. And certainly there are opportunities ahead of us if enough pressure is placed on the Obama administration to follow through on the rhetoric with action, is what you're saying, I guess. And that's incumbent on all of us to get out and grasp the opportunity that could be here in the next couple of years, right?
Well, Scott, let me interrupt. On May 2nd, there is going to be a rally in New York in connection with the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. So we'd like to see a lot of people in New York on that day.
May 2nd. A lot of time to organize for that.
That's right.
And reserve a day off. So what day of the week is that?
I believe it's a Sunday.
Okay. Hey, John, in closing here, I wanted to just bring up one issue which I found a little disturbing reading this in the news just the other day, that apparently the Obama administration is speeding up the production of bunker buster bombs to be ready for deployment in July 2010. And, of course, these bunker buster bombs are ordnance that can be used to blast through 200 feet of reinforced concrete. And many, of course, believe that these bunker buster bombs would be used to destroy nuclear programs in hardened sites within Iran or possibly North Korea.
Scott, are you talking about nuclear bunker buster bombs?
No, no. These, I believe, are conventional bombs,
okay.
High explosives, that anybody looking at the tensions between the United States and Iran in particular would say, well, these are the weapons that would be used either by Israel or the United States to do a preemptive strike to destroy Iran's nuclear program. And, of course, the U.S. and other nations are saying it's designed to design and build nuclear weapons. Iran says it's a civilian nuclear power research and not a weapons program. But, of course, just making a public announcement that these bunker buster bombs are going to be speeded up in terms of production gives you some pause and some concern, does it not?
Well, absolutely. It sort of looks like, we just saw what I hope is a breakthrough with Bill Clinton going to North Korea, meeting with Kim Il-sung there in connection with the release of the journalists. So, you know, the Obama administration and Obama, you know, rightly said they wanted to talk with Iran. And of course, the turmoil and the repression there make that harder, I think, to carry through on. And Biden and Hillary Clinton have been saying some very fairly bellicose things regarding Iran, somewhat different than the tone of President Obama, I would say. I think there is the potential for successfully talking with Iran, and then it looks. But if that is not carried through, it does not eventuate, I think there might be a move to really put some tough sanctions on Iran, like on the import of refined gasoline, you know, something that could really cripple their economy. And that in itself could sort of escalate things. Well, you know, people have been talking about the possibility of a military strike for years now. You know, whether or not that could happen, it's hard for me to say. But I think the supporters of peace have to say we don't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon and it shouldn't acquire nuclear weapons. And as an analyst, I don't think they've made the decision to do that. I don't see any particular reasons why they would do that, and that's the same thing that you hear a lot of members of the elite there say. They say, well, there's no strategic advantage to us to do that. So I don't think they made the decision. But I think that the peace movement has to say Iran should not acquire nuclear weapons, but in any case, the U.S. or anybody else should not go to war against Iran, even if Iran was to acquire nuclear weapons. You know, we have to come to grips with the fact that there are a number of countries in the world that have nuclear weapons, and we're going to have to reverse it on a regional and global basis. It's not going to work to go just, you know, country by country to threaten or bluster or sanction countries into saying we're going to give them up. It requires real politics and real diplomacy.
And, of course, the obvious double standard that the United States and the other Western European nations, with a wink and a nod, have given full approval for Israel to possess nuclear weapons. They're our buddy, they're our allies. But then to say other nations in the region, Iran, whether you like the Islamic Republic or not of Iran, the fact is this is a very stark double standard for anyone living in that country who, you know, has any degree of nationalism, right?
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. And but I think, you know, the population tends to see, they see nuclear technology as their sort of right of independence there. And it's a matter of anti-colonialism, just like steel or railroad is. But they're not just thinking as far as the weapons themselves, you know. They don't just look at Israel. You know, they can look and they can see Pakistan and they can see India and they can see Russia. And, of course, the United States is very much in the region. The United States has nuclear weapons. So from their point of view, it's a nuclear weaponized world.
Well, John, we're about out of time here. Let me just thank you so much for being here tonight to talk. And, you know, it's kind of a wide-ranging way about nuclear weapons proliferation and the related issues we discussed tonight, and direct our listeners, if you would, to a website or websites where they can get more information. As you said, the petition is there, a protest demonstration rally in favor of nuclear nonproliferation is going to be occurring this May 2nd, I think you said it was?
Yeah, nuclear nonproliferation and disarmament, getting rid of them altogether. Right. Well, you can just go to the website for my organization, Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, and the website is just the acronym LCNP.org, and it can take you to the petition and to information about the campaign.
LCNP.org, and then United for Peace, I believe, is the other group.
That's right.
That United has the petitions. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, John, thanks so much for being here, and thanks for all your hard work on this very important issue we really need to pay more attention to.
Okay. Enjoyed talking with you. Good night.
Thanks again, John. Bye-bye. That was John Burroughs, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. We're going to take a musical break here on WPKM in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk. Again, this program is Counterpoint. We're here every Monday between 8 and 10 p.m., and we invite you to go to the WPKN.org website, get some general information about this radio station, listener-supported, requiring your help to continue on, as well as go to our website for the Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, which is heard on this station several times a week, as well as on 50 other stations around the country, and it's syndicated right from this station. That website is btlonline.org, and some of the interviews you hear in long form are edited down into shorter segments, and all that audio is available through podcasts and a long audio archive stretching back 8, 10 years, and that's btlonline.org. And then Counterpoint is archived at the website whiterosesociety.org, whiterosesociety.org. Just look for Counterpoint there, and there's an archive of many of the Counterpoint programs stretching back a while, although we did have a gap a couple of months ago. But right now, thank you for listening, and we're going to take a musical break, as I said, and be back with a discussion on Afghanistan. Stay with us. music from Bruce Cockburn and something called Peace March. It's 27 before 10 o'clock. This is WPKM in Bridgeport and WPKM in Montauk. Again, this program is called Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, and right now I'd like to welcome to the program Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald. They are the authors of the book titled Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. And Elizabeth and Paul, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
It seems that there is a growing realization in the U.S. Mainstream media, and I think generally among the public, that the Afghanistan war is turning into a quagmire, and that, as Barack Obama promised during his presidential election campaign, he is going to change the focus of the United States to wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, to more fully focus and deploy more troops to Afghanistan, which he has with a recent addition of some 21,000 troops to Afghanistan. But even now, it looks as if the military, the Pentagon, and a lot of commentators are anticipating that there may be thousands of more troops that are required to deploy there to address a very dangerous and unraveling situation. But Elizabeth and Paul, maybe you can assess for us in short form what the situation in Afghanistan is in advance of this August 20th presidential and parliamentary election there.
It's a very strange situation in terms of what exactly the United States is trying to accomplish there. Certainly 17,000 troops or even doubling that number is not going to be enough to pacify the country militarily. And a lot of people have stated over the last couple of years they are fully aware of the fact that there is no military answer to this problem. And yet, at the same time, the military escalation continues. It does appear as if there's some kind of Vietnam quagmire mentality going on there. What's interesting is that the Obama administration was supposed to switch from a counterterrorism strategy, which had been initiated by the Bush administration in 2001 in the so-called War on Terror, to a counterinsurgency strategy, which would have switched the emphasis from hunting down Taliban and hunting down Al-Qaeda to actually building infrastructure, to getting the government in Afghanistan to work better, to gaining some kind of security for the villages and for the Afghan government so that progress could be done in reconstruction. And General Stanley McChrystal was a telltale sign. I mean, the man is not... He's called a counterinsurgency specialist, but he's actually a counterterrorism specialist. His expertise in the Iraq War was going out and finding the bad guys and going in at night and killing them. He's been described in a Newsweek article from a couple of years ago that I just happened to read today as a Jedi Knight. So this is the kind of aura, and this is the kind of thing that's been going on here. So it's really hard to say exactly right now where the Obama administration stands on their policy with Afghanistan.
But I think you really also have to factor in that, you know, I mean, at least going back to 2001 when the Bush administration really inaugurated the original invasion that drove the Taliban out, and that there were people at the time who were, you know, screaming, if you go off and run to Iraq, the Taliban are going to reemerge. Well, shock, shock, the Taliban reemerged. So I think we really have to hold, you know, our disbelief at some level and recognize that, you know, it's very late in the game that these administrations seem to finally catch up to the reality that they're really participating in. So, you know, in terms of the crisis that's sort of befallen the Afghan people, and that's where, you know, we come in. We've been looking at this crisis not from the viewpoint of American foreign policy, but from the viewpoint of the impact American foreign policy has had on the Afghan people for over 30 years. And it has been devastating, and it is continuing to be devastating. But when you can see that the answers are really already present, that there are people who are, you know, articulating, you know, common sense and what to do to, you know, basically try to, you know, sort of minimize the impact on the civilian population and help them restabilize the country and all these other things, it's never done. It's not been done. And this is really, you know, what we're here to talk about is this sort of this crisis in leadership that we're obviously facing, and try to throw some cold water on the sort of the rhetoric that keeps spewing out that doesn't seem to resolve anything when the answers really have been there all along.
As you point out, it seems there is a growing acknowledgement among those policymakers and commentators in this country that there really is no military solution to the conflict in Afghanistan. But if it's not a military solution, what should be done in your view, having studied and researched what is going on the ground there with the people of Afghanistan?
Well, this is where it gets really kind of sticky, okay? The fact is that we now have really created, vis-a-vis Pakistan, a very dangerous, militarized, situation that is represented by what the Taliban is trying to do again to Afghanistan. So the fact that it cannot be solved in terms of, you know, viewing this as simply strategic bombing. But the fact is that we do have to have a serious kind of security for the Afghan people and the Pakistani people that, you know, that absolutely puts their security at the top of the list. We need to bring a level of stability so that the Afghan people actually have the ability to bring back the fundamental reconstruction, the fundamental, you know, things they need to restart civil society. You've basically got a population of people that really, you know, their civil society has been atomized and really has never been brought back again. And this is really one of the things that's so disappointing to the Afghan people. As we researched the real causes of what drove the Soviets into Afghanistan in the first place and discovered that, in fact, it was a black project inaugurated by Zbigniew Brzezinski under the Carter administration to intentionally draw the Soviets into Afghanistan to give them their own Vietnam, and that Brzezinski was very determined to win the Cold War, obviously at the expense of the Afghan people. What we're looking at is sort of the aftermath of this, you know, this kind of miasma. And, you know, we're trying to simply bring some common sense to, you know, the needs of the Afghan people that have just been drawn along in this process, you know, since 1979.
Since 1973, the problem in Afghanistan has emanated from Pakistan. Pakistan has looked to Afghanistan almost as being its a fifth province. It has not really considered Afghanistan to be a legitimate entity from the very beginning of its own creation in 1947. There has been antagonism between the two countries. And, of course, in 1947, with the Cold War, Pakistan and Afghanistan got caught up in that kind of you're either on our side or against us. And that mentality is still very much in the institutional thinking in Washington, and that's a big part of the problem, is that the institutional thinking in a lot of things, not just in Afghanistan, Pakistan, but in a lot of things vis-a-vis the Soviet Union and China, as an example, still is echoing a kind of Cold War mentality, which of course grew out of almost a pre-World War II mentality. So, there's a lot of thinking that needs to be done about this, and it needs to be done in Washington. I mean, Afghanistan will respond as a nation to what it has to respond to. It's been a nation now since 1747. It's been invaded, as we know, from Alexander the Great on. So that we're talking, two millennia of invasion. So Afghanistan will still be there. This is really, in our mind, and from our investigations over the last 30 years, very much almost a mirror of the way the American foreign policy establishment works. And as we can see, it's very confused, and it's not monolithic either. So we have to get we had all expected and hoped that the Obama administration would come in and kind of clear the decks, get on with this situation. There were some very obvious things that needed to be done in Afghanistan very early on. They weren't done, but there was still a chance to do it. The Afghan people and the Pakistani people, I think, were looking towards the Obama administration as a breath of fresh air. And instead, I think we're really beginning to see that, especially as it regards the military policy, that what we're seeing is a military policy that is simply shifting from Iraq to Afghanistan without any significant changes in terms of the way those troops are being used and the way they're being deployed, and for protecting the Afghan people from the people who want to overcome their government.
We're speaking tonight on Counterpoint with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald. They are authors of the book Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. And Elizabeth and Paul, wanted to ask you this. On a micro level, it seems that the United States is battling for the hearts and minds of the Afghan people and, as in Vietnam, turning to what they say is nation building, although there are a lot of reports that whatever infrastructure that the United States has attempted to build there has not really been done very effectively. On the other hand, you have an increased use of air power in Afghanistan with increasing numbers of civilians being killed, the United States often shifting blame or denying that these civilians are being killed in these air raids. And I'm wondering from your perspective, in just the short run, in terms of stabilizing civil society there in advance of this August 20th election, what should the Obama administration be doing right now to do something different, to turn it around?
Well, that is actually part of our biggest concern about the, you know, addition of these, you know, effectively the 21,000 additional troops that were sent there, that, you know, the idea really was to try to bring some kind of, you know, sort of illusion of security, illusion of changed ideas, and all to try to, you know, sort of create a sense of legitimacy for the election. But once again, you know, we really have to realize on the ground, the Afghan people are quite aware of these manipulations. They're not satisfied with the fact that the Taliban are still being viewed as being talked about as negotiated back into the government. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar might end up being a very powerful political force. This man is a war criminal who was involved with the civil war at the end of when the last Marxist president was removed in 1992, the civil war took place with the Mujahideen, who had been heavily empowered by the United States and the Saudis during the 1980s. And these oftentimes were individuals who were absolutely criminals, drug lords, people who really, they might have been Muslim, but that really isn't the important part here, that, they really were criminals. And the idea of warlords was really an idea that actually didn't exist in Afghanistan preceding the Soviet occupation. These really are all outgrowths of the effect of America's policy decisions in order to, once they drew the Soviets into Afghanistan, to then fight them by drawing all these, these criminal Islamists from around the world, which really was what the Al-Qaeda database was about, was this database of Islamists that were invited to come and fight the Soviets. And once they came to the region, many of them stayed and became entrenched and empowered and also influenced the entire shift in the region, to an extremism that really was not necessarily present, especially in Afghanistan. So these are the kinds of issues I think that, President Obama has to really connect with, that no president really has connected with, and this is all part of what our story is about, what our research is about, is really looking back over, every administration since the creation of the state of Pakistan out of, like five-fifths of Afghanistan. And again, the regions that are under such focus for the crisis, the Pashtun areas. We keep hearing about the Pashtun nationalism, the Pashtuns, and who are now connected to the Taliban. These are the regions that were really separated under British colonial authority in 1893. That was an arbitrary line drawn down these homelands that separated Pashtun tribal homelands that were all once part of Afghanistan. And this is where you have a lot of your crisis. The Pakistanis really have never been accepted as the nation of status for these regions. They have been fighting for their own nationalism, and that has gotten kind of conflated into the whole issue of the Talibanism, simply because they happen to be drawn out of the Pashtun tribes. It's been, kind of mixed up as the same thing. But in fact, the Taliban was actually created by the Pakistani intelligence with the intent of guaranteeing that there would be a Pakistani-friendly government set up in Afghanistan.
The U.S. has gotten itself mixed up in a very ancient tribal rivalry that pits Punjabis against Pashtuns, against Balukis, against Sindhis. you know, it's very complicated. And the United States, unfortunately, the American government just simply has not exhibited the kind of sophistication that is necessary to go in there and know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. And a lot of the problem that's been going on with the America's situation in Afghanistan is that it has been relying on Pakistan to tell it exactly that. Who are the people who are causing the problems and who are the people who need to be supported? And unfortunately, in most of the cases, those things have been wrong. The United States has made the wrong decisions.
Well, the view from Pakistan has always been through the eyes of their struggle with India. And they always viewed Afghanistan as basically simply a place that they could use for their eventual war with India. So Afghanistan, you know, as a nation, you know, this is a nation that had a status in the region, you know, for thousands of years, and as a formal nation, you know, from the 1700s. This is a nation that got split in half by the, you know, British colonial attitude towards its inability to effectively colonize it. This is how they eventually, you know, basically broke it apart, by drawing a line down the Hindu Kush Mountains and simply arbitrarily separating the Pashtun homelands. And the people in those areas have never accepted the Durand Line as a legitimate line. And then that was used in 1947 to create the state of Pakistan, who then was able to really focus on their obsession with India vis-a-vis their relationship, their new relationship with the United States, that really viewed Pakistan as an ally in the Cold War scenario that suddenly, you know, was an outgrowth of the World War II you know, experience with the Soviet Union. So these are all the plays that kind of pigeonholed Afghanistan. You know, they were pigeonholed by the British Empire and the Soviet and the Russian Empire in the 19th century, and then they began to get squeezed, and you know, eventually squeezed now by the interests of the Pakistanis, and you know, what became their obsession with India. So this became this is now the play that is obsessing the region.
You see, in Afghanistan right now, there is no central political figure that all of these various ethnic groups can look to as a governing force. From 1747 until 1978, one family, the Durrani line of kings, ruled the country. And ever since 1978, that has been up for grabs. And right now, you have a situation where the Durranis were Pashtuns, and the Pashtuns, part of Pashtunistan, part of the Pashtun tribal area, was in what is today Pakistan. It had been in the 19th century Afghanistan. But the British, of course, in 1879, in the Second Anglo-Afghan War, seized that territory. So that created a problem that exists to this very day. If there's one spot on the planet that is a legacy, a direct legacy today, that the United States has to deal with of 19th century colonialism, it's Afghanistan. And that's the Pakistani state that was created in 1947 never really congealed as a state. They have a lot of ethnicity issues, as well as Afghanistan has ethnicity issues. And ever since 9/11, ever since 2001 and the U.S. invasion, the U.S. aligned itself with the so-called Northern Alliance, which were not the majority tribe. The Taliban were ethnically Pashtun, but the United States aligned itself with the Tajiks, the Hazaras, and the Uzbeks. And as a result of that, it automatically, from day one, created a problem that had been resolved since 1747, more or less loosely, by the Durrani royal family. When they brought the king back in 2001, it was hoped that he would provide that kind of figurehead status so that the nation of Afghanistan could be reunited as one people. But today, that's not the case. And everything that has been done since 2001 has mitigated against that kind of unity.
Well, actually,
I just wanted to interrupt you. I'm sorry, but I just want to get one question in here before we have to leave, because we're almost out of time, unfortunately. This is a great history lesson, Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald are our guests tonight. And I wanted to ask you both this. There was a recent U.S. drone attack that we're told in press reports killed Baitullah Masood, a leader of the Pakistani-based Taliban. And there are there's a lot of mixed messages coming from Pakistan in terms of the relationship with the Taliban, both in Pakistan and across the border in Afghanistan. But what can you tell us about the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence, and the nation, the government's relationship with the Taliban in general? Where is that headed? Is it open confrontation now between the Pakistani government and the Taliban in both Pakistan and Afghanistan, or is there really a lot of mixed messages going on?
Well, there are a lot of mixed messages going on, but you know, this is very similar the issue with Fethullah Masood as to what happened with Osama bin Laden. The Pakistani ISI opened the gateway for Osama bin Laden and the Taliban, as well as Al-Qaeda, to escape through Tora Bora when the United States was doing the bombing in 2001. The ISI was directly implicated in that, and helping these people. Fethullah Masood was one of the people who was directly involved in Waziristan in assisting the regrouping of the Taliban and with Al-Qaeda. So, once again, he was very, very well connected to the Pakistani ISI. And some people are suggesting that this is, once again, a classic example of the traditional pattern that goes on. With Fethullah Masood gone, it enables the United States to say, see, our predator drone attacks are working, we've broken up the Taliban, the Pakistani ISI is telling us that it's probably him. On the other hand, what it does is it enables the Pakistani Taliban to call off their assault on Waziristan, which they didn't really want to do anyway, which they really weren't prepared to do, and they can redirect their attention back towards the Indian border where their primary focus is. So this is kind of like the same old play over and over again.
It also might be connected to the Kerry-Lugar bill, which basically guaranteed that the Pakistanis were going to be replenished with billions of dollars, and that, you know, they had to basically show someone somewhere that they were, you know, qualified to receive all these billions of dollars. So it's very hard to know. We've already got reports now, they're denying that he was killed, they're saying that he was wounded, they're saying, you know, I mean, it's everything. And at some point you realize that, you know, there's no way to, you know, there's what we discovered with the whole Afghan story, going back to the origin of the Soviet involvement, was that the story got so propagandized from the get-go that there was no way to know what any truth was at all. And that's, you know, why it's very hard to really know for sure when you're not in a position to really dig into, you know, the actual documents and really look at them and see who said what to whom and how it really happened, what the real meaning of these things are. But, I mean, I think we do have enough evidence to suggest the probability that, you know, this is a very politicized event. This is definitely not just, you know, a clean hit.
Hey, I want to just ask you one final question, if I could, because what you're saying certainly sparks a lot of thought here. We're told that the Taliban are not a monolith, that they're various elements with various beliefs and philosophies and views of the conflict in Afghanistan. Should the United States negotiate with certain elements of the Taliban, in your view?
Well, I would start by saying that, you know, we've been told by many Afghans you have to view the Taliban and what they did to the Afghan people as the Nazis invading Poland. You have to understand that the creation of the Taliban, and even those Afghans that were drawn into it, many of whom were drawn in for economic reasons and for, you know, personal misery reasons rather than for ideological reasons. Okay, and there may be certain individuals that, you know, might be carrying a little bit of the ideology, but the majority of Afghans involved in it are not necessarily ideologues. It's for economic reasons. So what we're looking at really is a movement that really has more to do with Pakistan than it has to do with Afghanistan. And as I said before, the very creation of the Taliban was to create a Pakistani-friendly government in Afghanistan for its eventual war with India. That the idea was to basically have a weakened Afghan state that would be able to be subjugated for Pakistan's needs. This is certainly not acceptable to the Afghan people. Now, they're at the point now, this is what the problem is. The Afghan people are at the point, they're so desperate for any kind of resolution that they're at the point where they're trying to just say, somebody stop hurting me. And this is really, you know, what we're very concerned about. In the 1990s, when the Taliban took over Afghanistan, the actual treatment of women was termed gender apartheid. This was absolutely not just not acceptable, but this was actually a form of torture. This was a form of kidnapping. So when we talk about this idea of negotiating the Taliban, fine, negotiate those Afghans who basically want to simply live in Afghanistan, but giving them political power, inviting them into the government, having their philosophy that was really a product of, in many cases, their own being drawn into these things for their own, you know, desperate reasons. This is not acceptable to the Afghan people, by and large.
A lot of people in Afghanistan have blood on their hands, especially the Taliban. And what needs to be done first, before anything else can be done, before anyone is negotiated with, is some kind of reconciliation process. And that needs to be brought up. And I don't hear that coming from either the United States or the United Nations or even the NATO folks. But that needs to be done, because a lot of this stuff just simply has to be washed out of the system before anything can get anywhere close to normal.
Well, we just scratched the surface here. You guys obviously have a firm grasp of the history and the contemporary reality in Afghanistan, and I'd love to have you back to talk more about this. But Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, it's been great having you here tonight, and I know our listeners got quite a history lesson here this evening.
Thanks so much for
Thanks
having
so
us.
But we'll get back in touch and have
okay,
you back
okay,
soon.
Take care.
Thank Thanks. You. Okay. Bye-bye. Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, they are the authors of the book Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. That does it for our program here tonight on Counterpoint. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting this listener-sponsored radio station, WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. My name is Scott Harris. We'll be back next Monday evening between 8 and 10 p.m. with another edition of this program, Counterpoint. And do write us a call. You can call our phone number here during the day to talk to anybody, but if you want to reach me, I'm usually here a little while after the show, 203-331-9756. Email address is between the lines, all one word, at snet.net. The snail mail address for myself or anyone at PKN is WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. And the website again, WPKN.org. Thanks for listening, and do stay tuned to this station. Lots more coming up here tonight. Stay with us.
It's gonna be like a musical story.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, dramatic with music. Well, let me ask you this, man. Is this gonna be one of those, one of them?
A musical story. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.